step up and has to take on
security guarantees should come before any agreement.
The mechanism of принятия решений по использованию военных сил
has been verified as an age-slow, fragmented, constrained sideline.
The threat that I worry the most about vis-à-vis Europe is not Russia, is the threat from within.
Zerreißt Europa, zerreißt Deutschland.
The Art of Diplomacy, the official podcast of the Munich Security Conference.
Hello and welcome to The Art of Diplomacy. My name is Florence Gaub and I'm your host. And with me again is my co-host Joshua Jaffa. Hi Josh, how are you?
Hey, doing well. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you. At the Munich Security Conference in February 26, I think one of the things we observed, at least I did, and I know you did too and several others, was that Europe was, I was going to use the expression, growing up or moved from the moment of shock of February 25 into something that was perhaps more actionable or more busy. Was that something also an impression that you had?
Absolutely. I got a sense, as you say, growing up is, as good a metaphor as any, but that there now are some real plans afoot on a kind of tactical level, to borrow a word from the security sphere, about what does this actually look like? Europe, in other words, having a proactive vision for itself, not just being a passive recipient of whiplashing change emanating from the US, but actually having something to offer. I think it's still a process in its infancy. But still, a certain process has begun in which Europe is coming out of this initial shock, disoriented state, has to figure out what it's going to do in a whole number of spheres. Obviously, defense and security is one, but technology is another. And like I said, a certain process has started, but I feel like there's a lot more question marks than answers.
I think when we talk about ideas for what this continent could give, of course, you know, the conversation that we're going to listen to today with Benjamin Haddad, the minister delegate for European affairs in the French Ministre de l'Europe et des Affaires étrangères, which stands for Ministry for Europe and Foreign Affairs, which is, by the way, in itself a novelty. We've had ministers for Europe since the 80s, but actually Macron renamed this ministry to underline the importance of Europe for France. Benjamin has been in this post since 2024. In his previous life, he was a think tanker. He worked at the Hudson Institute and the Atlantic Council, and then he became a member of parliament. Obviously, France has been, since World War II, one of the drivers of European integration, and not just integration, of course, also for European, I'm going to say, defense identity. And you will remember the speech by President Macron, the Sorbonne speech, where he advocated for strategic autonomy, which was at the time seen by several people as anti-American or advocating transatlantic decoupling. Did you see it like that at the time?
Well, I know from my own reporting last year, for example, when I worked on a big story for The New Yorker about the future of NATO, that there was a certain sense of, I don't know if quite triumphalism, maybe something veering toward told you so attitudes among the French, who, as you know, and I'm sure many listeners are familiar, going back to the middle and latter part of last century, de Gaulle, France pulling out of the military component of NATO so as to retain control over its nuclear arsenal and the kind of use and doctrine surrounding that nuclear arsenal, that the French felt like in the age of Trump, that they simply were ahead of their time in understanding the rules of power politics, the kind of fundamental truths of the transatlantic relationship, that even in better, more conciliatory, friendly, let's say, times between Europe and the United States, there were still kind of structural reasons why that partnership, especially on a military basis, was always going to be limited. And now the age has come in which the French point of view has been taken from something beneath the surface and now put on the surface. And look, I don't necessarily know if it's true that the rest of Europe have become kind of French in their attitudes, but you see a drift in that direction. And I got a sense, as I said, reporting this story about NATO last year, that there were a lot of French diplomats, military officials, and people from that world who felt like, see, we were on to something all along, and it's high time that the rest of Europe understand that if necessarily not adopting full scale the French point of view, but that we have to be listened to, and these messages that we've been transmitting of the type that you mentioned about strategic autonomy have much more currency in Europe these days.
And so what's interesting, you know, when we talk about Europe, and we bemoan often as Europeans that there is no unified European position, etc. But how do you actually get to that position? Well, that's one of the jobs that ministers for Europe or minister delegate for Europe, it depends on the member state. But basically his role is to travel around Europe and to get the French position in front of the other Europeans and have them, you know, share their point of view more, consolidate and so forth. So I think we underestimate sometimes that Europeans, for them to be called Europeans in an international sense, first they have to come to at least a minimum of common understanding. So we have a subset of geopolitics or a subset of diplomacy, which is, if you want, inner European diplomacy. And I don't know if you ever looked in the machine room of that, but it's actually super complicated because there are just so many.
What I'm really interested in is the ways that that's changing. And here, I hope you can explain something about this to me. Perhaps Benjamin also will have something to offer in this interview. But the way that diplomacy inside Europe is taking on new forms, it doesn't necessarily look like the consensus diplomacy of some years ago in which, you know, the EU was the foundational body and that therefore you had to have at least some degree of agreement among member states. But now that's splitting into smaller subsets. Let's see if anything comes of, for example, this coalition of the willing that periodically talks about assembling some kind of peacekeeping force to Ukraine if and when there will be a ceasefire. Perhaps whether or not that mission happens, that somehow that grouping of countries becomes a relevant security player in an age when NATO is coming under more question about, is that really the most credible or kind of functioning security body, given the splits that have come up between the United States and Europe in the Trump age? Northern European countries, a kind of coalition ad hoc of Baltic countries and Scandinavian countries that have their own both threat perception, but also therefore investment and willingness to act on that threat perception, which might look very different than, say, Portugal or Greece, for example. And so I'm tracking and really interested in ways that the old institutional groupings might be slowly, if not losing their relevance, at least being augmented, maybe supplanted by newer, very much nascent being formed groupings that may or may not have a formal institutional basis. They may just come together over a certain issue, work on that issue, dissolve again. But I get the sense that the diplomatic game or of musical chairs is really changing in Europe. And I'm interested in that question.
And so what's also interesting about Benjamin, so he and I, we go back to a time when he was a think tanker. I was also a think tanker at the EU Institute for Security Studies. He was first at the Hudson Institute and then at the Atlantic Council. So not just a think tanker, also somebody who's lived in the US for 7 years. So that's a super interesting profile, I think, for a minister and who's working in foreign affairs to actually have really lived in another country. And he also shared a bit of insights into how it's different from being on the inside, trying to do all these things that you just described, trying to achieve this common position and so forth, or being the analyst on the outer rim, so to speak, who's writing, or even, you know, also a journalist like you. There is, I mean, it's obviously on a continuum. We're all looking more or less at the same thing, but there's different ways you do it. And that was very interesting insight that he shared.
Well, I think about these jobs existing on a kind of spectrum. Mm-hmm. With journalism, in a way, being on one end of it, which is I have the job of going around and, like, I hope, a very astute, kind of eagle-eyed doctor making diagnoses, right? Identifying pathologies and describing them in precise/gory detail. Mm-hmm. But actually, there my role ends, and I don't claim, desire, feel like I have any competency in coming up with policy solutions, essentially because that's a forward-looking kind of work, and that's just not the business I'm in. It's just not what I'm good at. I'm good at describing the past and the present, I think. Then you have analysts existing somewhere in the middle, think tank fellows, analysts, and so on, who come up with lots of policy papers, proposals, but perhaps slightly lower stakes. They can be bolder in some way because it's not necessarily like their ideas are going to be manifest tomorrow. It gives you a certain freedom, as I imagine it, to be a bit creative, unconventional. When I say the stakes are lower, that's no kind of diss against this work. Perhaps that allows for creative thinking that's harder when you get into government, but you don't face the consequences, political, geopolitical, tomorrow of an idea that didn't quite work out.
Yeah.
Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, you have people in government, Benjamin's role now, where the stakes are high. The stakes for the cost of a mistake can be quite high, especially in the security, defense, diplomatic realm. I imagine that makes you a bit more cautious. It's harder to just breezily and cockily throw around ideas the way that, you know, journalists at a bar might about, oh, we know how, you know, this war could be solved. Or even think tank fellows, too, have, I'm sure, oftentimes think, you know, if only they were the ones in the room, this whole mess would have been sorted out a long time ago. Well, it turns out when you're the one in the room, things start to feel a lot different and more fraught, pressurized, the kind of freedom for making a mistake really narrows. And so I'm intrigued and eager to hear about how Benjamin navigated that transition.
Thank you very much, Josh. Now let's dive right in. Here's my conversation with Benjamin Haddad. Yeah, you're running? Okay. So, first of all, welcome to our podcast, Benjamin. You and I know each other a little bit from your previous life. We'll talk about that in a second. Today, you are here as the Ministre Délégué of Europe. I think you can translate that into English. What is it that you do?
Well, thanks for having me first. It's great to see you. So I'm the Minister Delegate for European Affairs. So I'm deputy to the Foreign Minister, who's also in our system, the Minister for Europe and Foreign Affairs, Jean-Noël Barrot, who also happened to be my predecessor in this job. And so my job has a few aspects. One of them is to represent France in Brussels at the General Affairs Council, where we discuss issues such as the negotiation of the European budget, which is a key issue this year, what we call the multi-annual financial framework, so the seven-year budget of the European Union, from the common agricultural policy to the funds that we put in defense and security on AI. So that's really a key negotiation. I'm also in charge of everything related to enlargement policy. So we discuss the accession process of Ukraine, Moldova, the Western Balkans. That's in my direct portfolio. A big part of it also is, of course, to represent the France's European priorities in our media, in with our country, with our countrymen, to work on our bilateral relationship. I'm in charge of course, of the Franco-German relationship is a key issue for us, but also all the different bilateral relationship that we have on the European continent, whether that's with EU members, but also with countries like the UK or candidate countries to the European Union. I work with President Macron also on his European priorities, on European issues. And then a big part is the internal dimension in France of trying to make the case for what Europe does on the French soil, and especially the all the European subsidies, the European financing of projects that sometimes go a little bit under the radar, but from infrastructure to agricultural policy is key all across the country. And so basically, you know, if you want to sum it up, of course, my key job is to defend the French interest in Europe and our French priorities and to animate a little bit of the government's action on European dimensions and accompanying our foreign minister to do so.
So what the listener might not know is that this is a comparatively new profile, right? The foreign minister or the Europe minister didn't exist always in France, did it?
We've had a Europe minister for a long time. Sometimes it's a secretary of state, sometimes it's a minister. So that depends a little bit on the different priorities. But what's clear is that, of course, Europe has been at the core of President Macron's vision. Mm-hmm. Ever since 2017, his Sorbonne speech on European sovereignty, it's been a key line for him because we see that we're in a world of geopolitical turmoil, that the United States, it's progressively turning its back on Europe and has priorities shifting to Asia, shifting also inward looking with more and more protectionism and priorities at home. We need to draw the conclusions of this. We have the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine on European soil. We have also increased trade assertiveness coming from China. And so right now, what we need to do is, of course, invest in our unity, invest in our strategic autonomy by reducing dependencies on military, on tech, be much more assertive as a power. When you look at trade, where we're sometimes much more open, a little more naive than other partners like the US and China, who don't hesitate to subsidize and support their own companies to do made in America, made in China, where sometimes we tend to still work under the software of globalization and the end of history from the 90s and the 2000s. And so we've been really pushing Europe to take much more ownership of its own fate and security. And that's something that permeates, of course, through the president's action and through the government's action.
So there's, of course, a difference if you're a secretary of state or a minister. I think just, you know, having a separate minister for Europe, but also President Macron renamed this house, you know, the Ministry for Europe and Foreign Affairs. I think that's a very strong message. You said the moment now is unity. So your job is also to contribute to that. So what is, you know, most of your interactions are with other Europeans. What makes this moment so special in terms of diplomacy for your job is to deal with Europe at a time where Europe is really facing something important?
Absolutely. I mean, look, there's a few things to this. And clearly, right now, when you look at all the issues that we talked about, the negotiation of the budget, the defense issues, the economic matters, when we need to push really for a European preference and to support our own tech, our own innovators, our own actors on the industrial field, clearly one aspect that's core is building European consensus on this, and so building coalitions. And another one is speed, because we have institutions that we see, I think, the change in mindset right now that's coming from Europeans and all these issues that we're discussing. But sometimes our institutions can be a little slow, a little cumbersome. And so I think what's really important right now is try to be as agile and flexible as possible. And so sometimes when you can act and deliver at the 27 level, so all the countries from the European Union, you should do so. But when you realize you're not going to find a consensus, or sometimes it's going to be too slow, is to find the relevant format to be agile and move forward. Because I'm a pro-European. What does it mean to be a pro-European? It means, very simply put, that I think that we're much more powerful and effective when we act together than if we go divided between the United States, China, and Russia, all these major actors. That doesn't mean necessarily that I think that everything should go through the European institutions from Brussels. Look at what we're doing on Ukraine, on the security guarantees. We've built the Coalition of the Willing to bring together countries that want to support Ukraine, that want to shape the security guarantees for Ukraine for the day after ceasefire, and continue to support the Ukrainian army, and maybe put boots on the ground also to send a message of reassurance to Ukrainians and deterrence to Russia. We're doing this with like-minded nations. We also brought in the UK, because of course the UK is not part of the EU, but it's a key strategic and defense actor of the European continent. And so this is why we wanted to anchor them and build this with them. But we're also bringing like-minded countries that are not in Europe, but that share our values, mindset, and interests. I'm thinking of Canada, of Australia, of Japan. And so this is a sort of original format that we've created.
So I mentioned in the beginning that we know each other from your previous life. So you're a politician. You've been for a number of years, but of course you started out as a foreign policy analyst, as a think tanker. You were at the Atlantic Council, before that Hudson Institute in the United States. So this world was not new to you, but it's still different. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience from migrating from the observer position into the center of diplomacy?
Yeah. I spent 7 years in the United States, which was a very interesting time politically, because I arrived in late 2014. Trump declared his candidacy a few months later. So I saw his campaign, the full Trump term, and then the beginning of the Biden administration. So politically, of course, it was fascinating. And the think tank world in the US is very interesting because there's a much more back and forth between the administration, the think tanks, the private sector more generally. In Europe, you tend to have these things in silos. Mm-hmm. And so basically you'll choose your career in your 20s and you'll be a diplomat your whole life, or you'll be in the private sector, or you'll be a scholar. I think we're managing now more to build bridges and dialogue between these different worlds, because of course they have a lot of value added to one another. But in the US, when you look at the think tanks, very often you'll have people who used to be in administration or who are destined to go to an administration. So that gives already a more operational and more political mindset, I think, to the kind of research and production that is being done. And that's something that I've always found quite interesting, because, you know, one of the writers that had the most influence on me as a student is Raymond Aron, who's a French strategist and philosopher from the 20th century, a liberal, an anti-totalitarian, who was always very firm against fascism as well as against communism, including at a time where being a Marxist was very fashionable in French intellectual circles in the 1950s. And there was one experience that really struck Aron as a youngster, and he talks about it in his memoirs. He was studying quite abstract philosophy. He was looking at Kant and Hegel as a student, and so went to Germany to study between 1930 and 1933. Hmm. Of course, he saw things that completely, you know, took him away from very abstract philosophy, and he was interested in what was going on in the streets and in politics. So he comes back to France in 1933 and meets with a minister and gives him a lecture on the rise of Nazism and the danger that it represents for Europe. And the minister listens to it and says, oh, this is very interesting and very worrying and impressive, but what would you do if you were me? And then Aron is dumbstruck and doesn't know what to answer. And his entire life, each time he's written, was always to try to answer this question. And what he calls praxeology, so to put himself in the mind of the policymaker and to try to give concrete recommendations. And I think that's something that was always very important to me, and that I find maybe the think tanker being the bridge between the real academic, which I was not, and the policymaker, is to try to bring expertise, so try to bring understanding of the culture, of the region, of the history, of the economics of something, but try to shape it into something that's useful and digestible to the person that will have to make the decision. So that's something that I find interesting in the world of think tanks. Of course, when you're in the real world afterwards, I mean, you know, you realize that everything is more complicated. everything is more complicated. And I think, without boring about this, but I think when you're in government, you realize how issues like just even scheduling become so critical. Because look, I mean, right now, we have a war in the Middle East. And it's a question of, you know, and of course, it's focusing so much attention that the risk is that it takes the attention away from Ukraine, for example.
Yeah.
At a time where energy prices are rising, and this might empower Russia to increase its aggression. And of course, they know this. And this is something that they want opportunistically to take advantage of. And so when I'm talking about scheduling, it's really about prioritizing and keeping your priorities straight and trying to continue to focus on your agenda and your priorities when there's so much going on, when other things are taking you away from this agenda. And so I think all of this is really, I think, the challenges that you find in government. How do you also, for example, how do you continue to try to think strategically and long term when so much of what you're doing is also managing the day to day and even the constant inflow of information that's coming. And so I think all of these balances are something that you have to think through when you're either in politics or, of course, in government.
So I want to talk a little bit about negotiations. What do you think matters more, technical preparation or reading the emotions and tensions of others? Probably the answer is a bit of both, but what do you think is the secret sauce of negotiation?
I think not only both, but they reinforce each other. What I mean by this is I do think the reading the emotions and getting the information is absolutely critical. Whether that's in business, whether that's in politics, or whether that's in diplomacy. Because, you know, one of the skills that I find is often very underused and so important in life is just asking questions. Mm. When you have a conversation with someone, if you ask a question, someone is answering. Generally, if you think about it, your reflex is to think about what you're going to answer to that, how you're going to relate that to your own experience, for example, and actually forcing yourself to come up with another question, then a third question. When you go to a negotiation, you have to be very clear about what you want, what's your position, and you have to prepare. And this is why the technical work, both on understanding the technicalities of the issue and even what you want and staying firm on this is important to prepare. Like for any critical conversation, even when you're trying to negotiate a raise, you have to be very clear about what are your red lines, what you want, etc. But then the key is to have access to as much information. I would say it's a little bit of a strategic empathy. It's really forcing yourself to put yourself in the shoes of the other person to understand his or her worldview, interest, constraints, red lines. And the best way to do this, of course, is reading, preparing, but it's a lot about just asking questions, having access to the information, speaking less. If you end up in an exchange where you speak less and you get the other to open up more, I think generally that's a successful exchange. And so I think it's really the two reinforce each other.
Would you also say, because about emotions and empathy, you use your gut feeling sometimes when you talk to your counterparts to find out what they want or what could help them? Is that sometimes a trick?
I think that, this is international relations, politics. It's a lot about relations of strength. It's a lot about power. But I don't want to underestimate also the importance of personal connection and the importance of trust. Trust being that if you do a negotiation, sometimes these things are very long. Sometimes they follow you for an entire career. And when you're seen as reliable, when you're seen as someone who keeps your deal, that is important. And so that's the connection you create with someone. That's the reputation that follows you. I'm in politics. And maybe that's naive, but I really think you can have a successful political career without backstabbing people and without betraying people. And I will even go further than that, is that if you actually want to continue to have a lasting career and when people know that they can make deals with you, it's about negotiation, compromising, in parliament, for example, but they know that you will keep your side of the bargain. Well, that's important. That's important for how you can continue to work through and build these coalitions and compromises. We have right now in France a minority government with fragmented parliament, because I think, like everywhere else in Europe, we see our politics being more and more polarized, more and more fragmented. And I think that's something structural. It's not going to change overnight. And so it does ask of us to conduct also politics in a way that's a lot more about negotiating. I think our current prime minister, Sébastien Lecornu, has been very good at this, actually, in managing to find a compromise on the budget with the socialists by engaging a lot with them, by trying to understand their point of view. They're still in the opposition. They're opponents to us. And the prime minister comes from the conservative side in his career, and he has not reneged on his deep beliefs. But at the moment, we didn't have an absolute majority. And so getting to negotiate, getting to listen to each other and finding compromise and knowing that then when we find this compromise, it would be held on both sides. I think that's what allowed us to overcome this hurdle that we had been struggling with in the previous months of finding a budget for the country, which is, of course, in the general interest of everyone.
I want to come to an analogy that we often hear, that diplomacy is a game of chess. You will remember when the war in Ukraine started, people were saying that Putin likes playing chess. And then I think others said, I think it's more a game of Go. Is it actually a strategic game or is it something else altogether? Just people talking?
So I love chess, but I think it's a terrible analogy for life, for politics, for diplomacy. Because it's chess is a game that's where you always have a winner and a loser. And life is sometimes much more complex and much more gray. It's a game of perfect information because you see everything that's going on and you're not in the other person's head, but at least you can see every move that everyone is making. Unfortunately, life is not this way. Life is always asymmetric information. So I think maybe a more apt analogy would be poker. Poker, you have a part of luck, of course, because you have a hand. But it's not fully luck because you have some players who always win, including when they have their very bad hands. And so there's a part of bluff, there's a part of luck, there is a part of calculation and skill. I think it's pretty good generally to try to play very hard the good hands and not play the wrong ones. So there's also, you know, a part of skill and habit. And there's clearly a part of about trying to seek out information. So where the analogy finds its limit is that you cannot just ask someone what his hand is, but you can try to guess after seeing a few of the games, and you have certain players who are more aggressive than others. You have certain players who take more or less risks. And so you can start, I think, guessing and building up a form of empathy with other players. So I would say, with all the limitations, that it's probably a more apt analogy to chess. I'm not saying that people should start going playing online and start gambling money if they want to train to diplomacy. But yes, I mean, there's a mix of this, of course, and I think even in life, I mean, first you're always in situations that are not symmetric. If you look at international relations, you have countries that are more powerful than others. But that doesn't mean that through skill, through negotiation, through building relations, through also taking more risks sometimes, and sometimes being gambling a little bit, you cannot rebalance the situation in a negotiation.
Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, did you know the Moses theory? I was thinking of that earlier. Daniel Keohane told me that once. I don't know if you remember him. So it's an analogy of this. What's the role of the think tankers? Like Moses, you take the Ten Commandments and you bring them down to the Israelites. That's what think tankers do. They take the wisdom from academia and bring it to the politicians, but it's a separate story.
And so no one listens to you. You break it, and then you wait 40 years until finally you're vindicated.
Exactly. So maybe the analogy doesn't hold.
But you know, I had about the think tanker. It's interesting because I had this conversation with Shadi Hamid, who worked at Brookings at the time, who's a good friend, and he once wrote a piece about Syria. Where he was advocating for intervention in Syria. And at the time of the Obama administration, mm-hmm. and he knew the Obama administration would not do it. And he basically said there's two kinds of think tankers. One who tries to adapt to the administration's view and shape policy responses that might not be as ambitious as he wants, but at least he knows might be adopted by the administration. And the other one will actually look for whatever he thinks is the best possible outcome, mm-hmm. regardless of where the administration is, because he thinks it's his duty to write about the best possible outcome. And he considered himself to be the latter. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I should not be influenced by how the Obama administration thinks about Syria. I will write what I think is the best course of action. Huh. And I guess I remember this piece very well. I think he wrote it maybe 10 years ago, but I discussed it with him because I thought I may be actually the other group who is trying to look more for the impact and try to maybe shape in accordance to what I think might be realistically adopted as a course of action. But I think it's a very legitimate debate.
It is. And so Shadi Hamid is an outstanding scholar, yes. amongst other things, on the Muslim Brotherhood, wrote excellent books on this. Is still at Brookings, I believe.
Yes, I think he's still associated
still in
with
Brookings.
Them.
And so this is actually a good segue to my next question, because I had very interesting discussions with him and I didn't necessarily agree with him. Which doesn't mean we can't be friends, but it still means that we didn't share certain views. So this is a question actually also for you. It probably is even worse sometimes. In your job, you encounter people that have completely different positions. So how do you deal with that?
If you look at the European Union, I'm of the view that, we should talk to everyone, we should respect everyone. I think one of the strengths, what makes my job interesting is that you have 26 partners, all coming from their own history, their culture, their institutions. And you have to understand this, you have to grapple with this, and they'll build coalitions. And including with sometimes partners that are much more difficult, like Hungary, because on foreign policy issues, we still work at unanimity. We engage. President Macron has a dialogue with Prime Minister Orban, and we've managed sometimes to find compromises on issues like supporting Ukraine that are very important to us. Now, if you go outside, sometimes it is important, I think, to understand that you can have an incompatibility of interest because someone has decided that you're the enemy. I mean, if you look at diplomacy with Russia mm-hmm. over the last decades, you've had several American and European partners. We've engaged also with President Putin, but it takes two to tango. When you have a regime that basically sees you as the enemy and has built its entire narrative around being an enemy to the European Union, NATO, the European security architecture, then it becomes extremely complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think these are moments where you have to be very lucid and realistic. There's a French philosopher that said that it's the enemy that designates you.
Yeah.
There's a French philosopher that has a saying that says it's the enemy that designates you. And you can be a pacifist. You can say, you know, send all the messages of friendship and goodwill. If the enemy has decided to designate you, then there's incompatibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something you could say also about terrorist groups, about apocalyptic organizations like ISIS, where clearly, I mean, here you are in a state where someone just doesn't accept even your existence and wants to destroy you. And these are moments, of course, in international relations where you cannot conduct diplomacy. Yeah. You are in a state where you need to use force.
I find it super interesting because in some circles in Europe, you know, there are people that are saying, oh, why don't you negotiate with the Russians and then we could, you know, just put an end to this war. And my argument was always, it's not a diplomatic problem, it's a political problem. If you have, like you say, incompatibility of positions, then the best diplomats in the world cannot find any grounds to walk on.
No, and this is why the best course of action here is to have a mix of the two, where you put a lot of pressure and you try to change the calculus of the regime by increasing the sanctions and making it costly economically, by continuing to support Ukraine militarily so they can have the upper hand on the ground. Because right now, when you look at even the negotiations that are underway, you can see that Russia keeps escalating on the ground with bombing of civilians and infrastructure in Ukraine. You can see that it continues to make maximalist demands that are completely unacceptable. And so the only way to hope to bring them sincerely to the negotiation table is, of course, to dramatically increase the pressure. Diplomacy is a dialogue backed by force, by a relation of power. Mm-hmm. And it's a mix of the two. But of course, putting that power and force element here is, I think, necessary if you want to create the condition for diplomacy to be successful.
You said earlier to me, I'm not a diplomat, I'm a politician, but you're working in diplomacy in the 21st century, which obviously is very different from, well, the last century or the one before. In fact, you know, the concept of ambassadors and embassies was developed precisely so that states could communicate to each other in the absence of all the communication tools that we have today. So how do you think is your work today defined by the fact that you do this in the 21st century as opposed to Talleyrand, for instance?
It's exactly what you said, right? I mean, diplomats and ambassadors started at a time where you didn't have all these connections. You couldn't text your counterpart. You couldn't travel back and forth. I mean, when you look at when the Versailles Treaty was negotiated, I think President Wilson spent 6 months in Paris mm-hmm. during the negotiation. Yeah. And of course, this is impossible now, and people would just go back and forth flying. So, but at the same time, we're in a world that's more and more interconnected, where we have diasporas, where we have economic exchanges and supply chains across the world, we have much more dependencies, where international events affect what's happening domestically. And I think what we're going through right now is a very good example, once again, of this. So you do need more than ever diplomats, you do need more than ever ambassadors, but the job is quite different. And I think in this respect, of course, you need people who are experts who can bring you, from my perspective, you know, bring you the expertise, the analysis of what's going on in the countries in which they reside. But aspects that are much more public or more critical than ever. I'll give you just two examples. One, of course, is economic diplomacy. What we expect from our embassies is also to help bring investments, either French investment to these countries or investments from their host country to France, and so to promote these relations and help our companies and help, you know, the facilitation of trade. That's one big area. Another area that's really critical is public diplomacy. And public diplomacy being means, and sometimes it's a cultural revolution. It means being on social media. And being on social media is not easy when your job is, of course, to be very careful about what you say on a daily basis. I think a lot of people have noticed French Response, the French diplomatic account that is quite active on social media, on X especially, to push back against disinformation, to push back against operations that we've seen trying to destabilize our information space. But clearly, you need diplomats who are more active on social media, who engage also with universities, with think tanks, with the media to make the case. And I think in certain respects, diplomacy has become much more horizontal. You know, what I mean by this is that you had in traditional diplomacy a very vertical approach where you have the state that mandating a diplomat and going sometimes very secretive way. When you're thinking about Talleyrand and others, it was very opaque, it was very secretive to conduct diplomacy. Part of this is still true and still necessary when you have very strategic issues. But now it's much more horizontal because I see the diplomat and I see clearly my role more as being the nexus of a network, at the heart of a network of people who can amplify in sometimes very independent ways French's voice on the world stage. Look at, we're talking about companies, diasporas, think tanks, all these areas, scholars, you know. Take the Munich Security Conference. Clearly, the Munich Security Conference, it's a private organization, it's a think tank, it's independent, but it's, of course, it's a key area of diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And of course, we, the French, need to be present there to make the case, to talk, to explain, to listen, to explain our view on the world affairs. I think for a long time, actually, we were not present enough in this forum. I started going there as a think tanker 10 years ago. I would go to places like the Warsaw Security Conference, and we were very few French. And I think we've considerably invested in engaging these fora that are critical today in foreign policy. And you have scholars, and of course the scholars are independent. They're not agents of influence of France, but they can also help our counterparts and our friends in Europe decipher what the French government thinks. You have journalists, you have companies that participate to these forums. And so I think clearly here, the diplomat can be more of the animator of a team that helps to be a vector of influence, a vector amplifying the French voice.
And you're an influencer.
to a certain extent, yes.
Yeah. So I want to end our conversation on a little game. You know, would you rather have this or that? So you have to choose one.
Okay.
And it's going to be hard. Okay. So you have to choose between two diplomatic superpowers. Would you prefer to have perfect knowledge of your adversary's intentions or have perfect trust from your allies?
Perfect knowledge.
Yeah. Why?
Yeah. Because I think that's probably the hardest to get. And I think that's probably the most critical, I would say, in negotiation is to have access to the information.
Interesting. I for some reason I thought you're gonna pick the trust because you mentioned trust earlier, but probably you're thinking trust from your allies is easier to rebuild than to get all the information on your adversary. Would you rather have 10 years of diplomatic patience or one decisive moment of political leverage?
It's a very complicated question.
Yes.
I will give a very disappointing answer because I think it's really interesting. I think both go along actually, because you have these moments where you build on something, you work on something for years, and you lay the groundwork, and sometimes nothing happens. And you'll have, for some reason, sometimes you'll have an acceleration of all of this, where decisions are made. But it wouldn't happen if the groundwork hadn't been laid for such a long time. Mm-hmm. So this is often what happens either in international relations or in politics and everything, in business as well, where I think you suddenly have moments of breaking points, but that are the consequences of everything that's been festering behind.
So one creates the other.
Yeah.
Last question. Would you rather have a brilliant strategy or a perfect personal relationship with the other negotiator?
I think you never have a brilliant strategy. So I would go for the second one. You know, I believe very much in, I think one of the best saying about this is Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
Everyone has a great plan until they get knocked in the face, punched in the face.
This is perfect. So we've gone from Hegel to Mike Tyson. This is probably the widest we've gone in this podcast. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And for sharing all your insights with us.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Art of Diplomacy, a podcast of the Munich Security Conference, produced by Studio Bummens. The show is hosted by Florence Galp and Joshua Jaffa, with original music by Jakob Ilja. The Munich Security Conference production team includes Andreas Block, Marie Zeisler, Judith Sorden, Noor Saad, and Annalena Enold. For more on this year's Munich Security Conference and for footnotes and references for this episode, please consider our show notes. Most of the conversations in this podcast were recorded at Bayerischer Hof at the Munich Security Conference in mid-February 2026. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow the show and leave a review. That's it for today. Thanks for listening.